Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I take what you made, but I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I take what you made, but I got to put you down.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us once again on Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. Patrick Connor of Knuckles and Gloves, the Fight City, Oregonian, some other places. And with us, we have author and filmmaker, Bryn Jonathan Butler. How's it going, man?
It's instead of hiking around Washington Heights, we're at a Washington Heights coffee shop because the power has been out at my apartment building for the entire day, so... Listeners who appreciate my wonkiness with regard to geography will appreciate the noise in the background.
Well, I think that it all, maybe it wasn't the first time you were ever like on the show. It might've been the second time, but when Foley was still on and you were in Roy Jones' farmhouse in his barn and shit, that was obviously an epic podcasting moment.
It's
but I mean,
precedent.
You know, you've traveled from, you know, all around New York City down to Florida. It's been a journey on the podcasting episodes here, man.
Well, now it's a gentrified coffee shop in Washington Heights, so I hope people appreciate that aspect.
Well, that boxing card this past weekend was a little gentrified too, with the Tyson Furies and the Carl Framptons. No, I'm just kidding. It wasn't so bad, but I mean, the big news that came out of the Tyson Fury and Carl Frampton card was that, of course, right afterward, Tyson Fury versus Deontay Wilder was announced and confirmed by Showtime as official, and is going to be happening in the next few months. And yeah, I mean, that's pretty big news. That's a fairly large heavyweight fight, no pun intended.
No, it absolutely is. It's great news. It will, you know, be a massive seller wherever it is. And I think it also puts some real pressure on Joshua that we're going to see Joshua fight the winner inevitably, because there's just nobody else really out there after, you know, Wilder puts the pressure on him by taking out Fury from the equation of a very logical opponent in terms of being able to sell a fight in the UK for massive numbers. If Fury is dispensed with in, you know, short order, there's nowhere for Joshua to go without, I think, the consensus feeling of fans being that he's ducking Wilder. So I love this fight for a lot of reasons, even though I think the fight itself is going to be, you know, a ridiculous mismatch. But I think it'll be fun while it happens. I mean, what are your feelings about it?
I tend to agree. I mean, I've kind of had the same sentiment ever since. I mean, look. If you're a fighter who's got like one signature performance or win on your record, and that's not to say that everything on Tyson Fury's entire ledger is bunk apart from the win against Vladimir Klitschko, but that's obviously a massive standout on his ledger. But if you look at the rest of his record though, I mean, there's like not much to it. And that's okay, because if you have a win like that, that's not a bad standout win at all. But, again, apart from that, it's pretty thin. And, I mean, it's just not the kind of... when you kind of look beyond his overall record and you look at his kind of quote-unquote comeback, what he's coming back from, you know, admitted drug addiction and psychiatric issues... The combination of the two is, you know, pretty rough, but nonetheless, he seems to have conquered them, and he also is coming back from a more than 100-pound weight gain, a really large dude. I think that there's a very good chance that he put on a lot more mileage in a relatively short span of time outside of the ring than he really did inside of it, And it's also kind of demonstrated that in his last couple of fights, where he's looked a little bit, just a little bit kind of laborious, a little bit, he's obviously not in great shape. He looks a little bit rusty. He still has skills, still kind of tricky, still kind of awkward, and that's part of what makes him, you know, an effective guy, especially for his size. But would he, even with Deontay Wilder's awful technique, which has been noted, lampooned, gift, shared, memed, etc., is he going to be able to avoid that, though, for 12 rounds? Is Tyson Fury going to be able to avoid those wide-ass swings for 12 rounds? Maybe from a guy like Steve Cunningham or something, yeah. But from a guy who's got, like, a whole nother almost foot of height on him, no, that's an exaggeration. He's probably, like, 5 inches taller than Steve Cunningham. But still, that's significant. He's almost as tall as Tyson Fury. Fury's not going to have a very big size advantage or reach advantage, if he does at all. And I think it's going to be very difficult for him to go through 12 rounds avoiding Deontay Wilder, because what seems to happen with Deontay Wilder is he looks kind of shitty. If you can't take him out, he's going to basically flail wildly and eventually catch you. And it's not super pretty. It's kind of crazy, sometimes fun, entertaining, but I feel like that's the least that's probably what's going to happen. If Tyson Fury has any success at all, it will probably be nullified at some point by a crazy-ass Deontay Wilder flail.
I agree with all of that. I mean, I don't see Tyson Fury, other than his ability in like a professional wrestling sense, to sell his fights being that different from Nikolai Valuev. I mean, he's 70% sideshow, 30%. He's a decent contender. You know, he's difficult because he's so freakishly large, but I don't think he has a lot of ability. I completely agree with your assessment that outside the ring has done the lion's share of erosion of his ability. I don't think your body bounces back at his age from the kind of, you know, self-destruction he's imposed on it, be it with substances, mental instability, mental health issues. You know, he's a pretty fast-living guy, and the kind of hardware he came into the world with seems fairly evidently, you know, bug-ridden, to say the least. Boxing, getting smashed in the head isn't going to help it. And one of the things I think Wilder doesn't get a lot of credit for is he really is trying to make statements. And as much as people bitch and complain about, we need a heavyweight who's out there trying to knock everybody out, they get it with somebody like Wilder, and okay, it looks clumsy, it looks a little, you know, strange,
yeah,
but
it's true.
He is trying to deliver, and I've never felt like he's taken his foot off the gas, and, you know, he's somebody really out there trying to make statements, and I would anticipate that he would recognize this being the biggest fight of his career as far as visibility. He's going to try and make the biggest statement of his career in trying to take somebody like Fury out in the first round. And I like that because I think it would give him a real claim to say, you saw what Klitschko couldn't do against this guy. Look what I can do. Can you imagine what I would do to somebody like Joshua? Now, I don't think that's a realistic argument, but it's a fun argument. It's an argument that I think would galvanize a lot of fans to – even, I mean, as it stands now, it's a huge pay-per-view bonanza, Fury and Joshua. I'm rather Joshua and Wilder. But if you knock out Fury in the first round, I mean, as you say, he's got the signature win and the name the next best win that he has for Fury. I just think in terms of iconography, that would be a great look for him to have highlight reels around the world of him just destroying Fury. Even though I don't think that's much of an accomplishment at this point. But I just think it would just set up Joshua so nicely for him. And I think that he's going to go out there and do it because, and this is what he doesn't get the credit for, he's done it his whole career. He's been trying his best, I think, to get this big fight. And I think that Joshua's been avoiding him. That's just my feeling. I mean, where do you sit in terms of who's to blame for Joshua Wilder not happening?
Well, I think that it's fair, first of all, to say that kind of as a baseline, the vast majority of boxing fans seem to feel that Anthony Joshua versus Deontay Wilder is a fight that should happen now. It's a good fight. It's a fight we want. And it's a fight that is pretty much universally accepted as the best fight at heavyweight right now. And something that would decide a fairly clear best fighter around. Where you sit on the whole lineal thing with Tyson Fury is a bit more, I guess, preference. Nonetheless, as far as, like, you know, the negotiations and everything, I'm not going to lie and say that I followed the total ins and outs of all of the negotiations. One, that usually doesn't really interest me that much in fights overall, unless there's something particularly intriguing. But as far as, like, you know, negotiations and who signed what and who got what, I don't usually follow it. However, from what I've read or what I've seen, it sounds like there was a contract sent to Deontay Wilder. He countered with some conditions, got something minor, but then when he signed it, Joshua wanted something else, and some of the terms of the contract seemed to change overnight, type of thing. Or, you know, it, in other words, it was a fairly normal negotiation in terms of a fight contract, except for the guy with the majority of the pull kind of was like, well, nah, I want more, and if you're not going to give it to me, then we're not going to fight. But then what made it kind of, I don't want to say suspicious, but made it kind of look wonky, was that it was like, you know, 2 days later, Anthony Joshua had to fight with Povetkin all lined up. So, I mean, I'm exaggerating. It was probably like a week or two. But nonetheless, it was very quick. And it seemed to suggest to me that the plan with Hearn and Joshua, who are probably not going to be prone to just making snap decisions about Anthony Joshua's career, the plan was probably that they need to deal with Povetkin on the level of having to, you know, deal with that to keep his belts. Because that leverage is good to have, generally speaking, and then from there, see what they were going to do with Wilder. I don't know that they totally expected Deontay Wilder to be able to come to terms with Tyson Fury, though, because Tyson Fury is kind of a kook and can be kind of crazy in terms of negotiating, or seems to, you know, perhaps have a somewhat inflated sense of self worth or pull, I guess, but that might not be true because he's pretty popular too. Either way, they made the fight. And I think that that's probably from a, you know, from a PR standpoint, that's probably the worst thing that could have happened to Joshua and Hearn in this entire situation, because it makes them look bad. It makes them look bad that the Wilder fight isn't happening in the first place, from what I've read, again, and if I'm wrong, somebody feel free to correct me, but it makes them look bad in the first place, and then again makes them kind of look bad because Deontay Wilder was like, all right, well then I'll fight the guy that everybody says is the lineal champion and, you know, hasn't really suffered a defeat like that yet, and we'll see what's up. And I think that if Deontay Wilder is able to destroy Tyson Fury or able to really decisively take a win from him inside the distance, that's a lot of leverage against Anthony Joshua, especially in the UK, where Anthony Joshua seems to be a somewhat polarizing figure.
I mean, I think he's going to go in there and try to use it as his own ersatz shitty, you know, Tyson knocking off Spinks. You know, like, they're knocking off the lineal guy was very satisfying. And it's very satisfying the way in which he did it, you know, which was so upsetting to the people who were predicting it. This is a version of that because, I mean, as you say, Fury laying claim to what he accomplished against Klitschko, nobody can ever take that away from him. That, you know, that was absurd how well he fought that day, and also I think how shitty Klitschko fought that day. But that wasn't a shot or washed up Klitschko. Like, Fury found a way to win against one of the great heavyweight champions in history. So will always be the lead thing in his obituary for the rest of his life. And it's one of the, you know, the great accomplishments, I think in the last, you know, 10 years, that was a shocking win for him. Not that he was Buster Douglas or anything, but I mean, it's a major, major accomplishment. But that being said, it's like, it just plays so into the hands of Wilder that you've got a clearly diminished version of Fury just served up to you on a platter. And Fury is going to sell the hell out of that fight. I think he's only going into it to get a massive paycheck. Fair enough. He's earned that. But I mean, I think this could easily be, as I say, a kind of Tyson Spinks 90-second, just wipe the floor with him. Because, you know, that table is set in terms of what we've seen from Fury, you know, the damage he's done to his body, the mental instability, abuse outside the ring, wear and tear in the ring. I mean, if you were Wilder or people representing Wilder, I mean, it doesn't get much better than this in terms of the kind of money, positioning from a victory of this fight, and in terms of how much risk. I don't think there's much risk for Wilder in this fight at all, frankly.
Unless his chin is just really destroyed or something like that, and it doesn't seem like it is, because he got hurt pretty badly by Luis Ortiz. He's been hurt by other guys, and even though he does get hurt, he seems to recover somewhat quickly, or at least do the right things in order to come back from being hurt. Against Ortiz, I remember tweeting during the fight something along the lines of this would be really Deontay Wilder-esque if he were able to come back from being hurt this badly and knock Luis Ortiz out. And of course, that's exactly what happened. I didn't expect that to happen. It seemed like he was on his way to getting his ass knocked out, and he just didn't. That's been the case a couple of times. So I think that unless it's some sort of cumulative thing, I think that Deontay Wilder, for the most part, has shown that he's tough enough to pull through that. And I don't know that Tyson Fury has shown that he has quite the punching power or the overwhelming type of style that would, you know, be required to really decisively stop Deontay Wilder. I could be wrong about that, but yeah, I think the risk is pretty low for Wilder overall, and he has quite a bit to gain. However, the flip side that we haven't considered yet, what if Tyson Fury puts it together?
then you're looking at, I mean, is it Mayweather Pacquiao in terms of pay-per-view numbers? No, but it's probably number two, or I guess three after the McGregor. I mean, I don't know if I consider that a boxing pay-per-view, but top three all time. If he comes through, especially if he comes through with, like, if he knocks out Wilder, I mean, could you imagine? And I agree with everything you said. I was press row for Wilder Ortiz. I couldn't believe that Wilder survived that. And I think Ortiz punches twice as hard as Fury ever did. And, you know, we're talking, Ortiz is a 50-year-old man, but he's, or 60 even. But, I mean, he just hits like a mule. And exactly as you say, Wilder took it, shook it off, and came back and dispensed with Ortiz, who was very game that night. Ortiz, it wasn't a lucky punch. I mean, he went in there to close the show, and Wilder found a way to win that fight. That was a lot of adversity, which is the same thing we saw with Joshua against Klitschko. You know, he overcame a lot of adversity there. He was really tested. So I give Wilder full credit for that, but I also think you make a good point. I don't know that Wilder has a great chin, and he definitely has a style. I mean, that's a charitable thing to assign to somebody like Wilder. But whatever that is that he uses as a method of combat, leaves him, to say the least, very, very open. And so I just don't think that poses much of a risk against Fury, because Fury doesn't really have he's not much of a puncher. I don't even know if I call him a boxer. He's just so unorthodox. And I think he's a clever fighter, but I don't see him as a particularly dangerous fighter, and I certainly don't see him all that dangerous 30, 40 pounds beyond his optimal weight. And with age and the wear and tear, I think this is – I really see like a very, very early stoppage. A lot of experts have sort of said, no, it's going to go midway through the fight or something like that. But I think it could – I just think it's tailor-made for a first round. That being said, Fury is crafty. He's dangerous. He's formidable. If he's able to pull it off, geez, I mean, the sky is the limit in terms of you think, you know, he's mouthy right now. My God, him selling a Joshua fight down the road. I mean, I think it'd be amazing. I don't love these kind of fights, frankly, where I don't really root for either guy. I'm just rooting for the best outcome possible in terms of creating the Joshua fight. So I just would really like to see it happen.
I think that, I would really hope that at this point, the public outcry, or, you know, I guess that's kind of a relative term, the, you know, boxing public outcry, that is. So like all, you know, a couple hundred of us would be enough that whoever it is that wins, you know, really needs to fight the winner of Anthony Joshua versus Povetkin, who I would assume is Anthony Joshua at this point, but that's, I guess, its own discussion, I suppose. But anyway, there should be pressure for that to happen.
Absolutely should be pressure. And I don't, you know, I think there's danger. I don't think Povetkin is a walkover opponent for Joshua. I think Joshua's chin is very suspect, and I think the stamina thing is just there as a liability. Somebody may take advantage of it, have a good day while Joshua has a particularly bad day. But I mean, Joshua absolutely should be heavily favored in that fight. But boy, if he loses to somebody like Povetkin, the heavyweight landscape changes, demonstrably. So yeah, it's interesting maneuvers that are going on right now. And I just wish it wasn't so protracted. All this just seems so, you know, just goes on and on and on without seeing the fights that people want to see. And there's just no excuse for that when there's so much money for them to be happening. I mean, Hearn, I think, deserves a lot of criticism for this whole fiasco.
It really was kind of it really depends on what happens, I guess, in the next couple of fights, you know, between Wilder and Fury and Joshua and Povetkin. But if something winds up happening in the meantime, or one of those fights gets delayed, something happens with a cut or a foul or some shit like that, and it gets all messed up, then it is going to, in retrospect, going to be we should have struck while the iron was hot kind of thing, and we missed our opportunity. I hope that's not what it winds up being, but it could, if, it's a gamble. And that's why, especially in the atmosphere of boxing today, the idea of letting fights marinate when, you know, they're totally fine to make right now is potentially a mistake, especially when both guys are recognized as is and don't really need to build their star power, as it were. It's a gamble. And it's something that you hear promoters say somewhat often. And I think that more often than not, it's an excuse. It's usually the fights should happen sooner rather than later in this landscape.
Well, and I think Fury is a ticking time bomb. I mean, he loses big. I don't think we're ever going to hear from him again. You know, he'll go the way of Michael Spinks,
yeah,
except he won't,
for
he
that
won't
and
land
other reasons,
comfortably.
Yeah.
Yeah, no,
yeah,
exactly.
For that and other reasons. It's just, you know, it's a gamble when guys are fighting once, twice a year. And, you know, when you're fighting once or twice a year and in the lead up to a fight you get injured, then that turns out to you fought once on that calendar year. And, you know, it just means that these opportunities to actually make these fights happen shrink very, very quickly. And I understand that some fights are difficult to make and take long training camps and blah, 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 but it's just kind of, you know, especially from a historical perspective, it winds up just sounding kind of stupid. You know what I mean? Like, you don't need a fucking 6-month-long training camp. You don't need to negotiate over the course of 8 weeks. It's just kind of ridiculous. So pushing it off, and it's a massive gamble.
Yeah, and you know, and boxing is just having quite a long list of guys where we're just losing them for a long time in their prime. You know, losing a couple of years off of Mikey Garcia, losing Andre Ward for a while. And these aren't injuries, but it's just the politics and stuff outside the ring. Like, it's just not a good look for our sport that we have a lot of guys sitting on the shelf, or just the business of boxing now, as you say, is once you get to a very privileged position that you only fight once or twice a year. You know, early on watching Tyson, it was very frustrating after, you know, he's fighting every 2 weeks or something, and suddenly it's like, oh my God, he's at this pinnacle position, and every time he was on HBO, it's like he's just had his longest layoff of his career, and then it would be even longer the next time, and then an injury before a fight, then fights being delayed, canceled, and all that. It just became like a theme with him, and you'd think like people would learn from that to sort of maximize their earning potential by taking more fights or seizing opportunities, even if in the short term you're not going to make as much money, and yet all this whole marinating bullshit. It's just frustrating. I don't know. I think it's another time where boxing is just shooting itself in the foot for general fans, because obviously the junkies like us are going to watch everything, but you know, casual fans are just going to be, you know, as we saw with Ward, it's astounding that you'd get to a place of fighting an undefeated Hall of Fame, top 5 pound for pound guy, and no casual fans gave a shit, and even less of them cared about the rematch after a very great first fight. I think a lot of it comes down to the momentum in pushing somebody like Andre Ward as the last American gold medalist. You know, he destroyed it by his own political maneuvering to try to get himself in a better position. But in the process, you know, it was, you know, you need people to keep hearing your name in a way that's exciting, where they want to learn more about you. And boxing has a lot of guys where it's not very well managed.
No, it sometimes does not seem to be. And it's hopefully doesn't wind up being a massive missed opportunity. But, yeah, a lot could happen in the remainder of 2018 at heavyweight. Hopefully it's the right things, and hopefully we get all the fights that we want. But I guess a consolation kind of along the lines of what you said. I mean, we're the kind of boxing fans who are going to watch all the fights or any kind of fights or whatever. But a consolation is, in the meanwhile, Joshua Povetkin and Wilder Fury are not bad fights. And at worst, they're both pretty intriguing fights. Joshua Povetkin could potentially be pretty explosive, however it winds up going. And Wilder Fury is at worst intriguing. I don't really know in terms of how styles go. I mean, you seem a lot more confident about how it'll go than I do, but I'm pretty confident Wilder will win. I'm just not sure how he'll look early on, or if he'll kind of be lulled to sleep by Fury's style, as he has been by a couple other guys in the past. But regardless, I don't think that either are bad fights. It's just that neither is the fight that we really want.
Yeah. Well, and I feel a certain responsibility to listeners to make bold claims that 95% of the time are flat wrong. You know, I need to live up to that here also. But no, I think they're both really good fights. They're just not the ones that we want to see at this point, but they're not, you know, laughably bad matchups. It's just at some point it's like enough preamble. Let's get on with it. As you say, the money is there. We know very clearly what the fans want. These guys have distinguished themselves in terms of their class and accomplishments to get it on. So another delay, I just think it's at this point far too much risk for, you know, the money is there now. So what's this big delay? You know, there are other times where marinating, I can see, you know, it's been proven that there was, you know, even Pacquiao Mayweather in terms of business, probably was a lot bigger the way it was, even with Pacquiao losing and losing huge to Marquez. But I still would have rather seen it 3 years before. I think it would have been a lot better for the sport, for the well-being of the sport, had it happened when it would have been a lot more competitive. And in the end, it was good for the people who were cashing the checks and not really good for anybody else. So I'm always more for making the fights happen that are good for the sport to sort of help legitimize it more than maintaining this sideshow sort of business model that it seems so addicted to.
Yeah, and it's really falling in love with the numbers. And, okay, you know, that seems to kind of just be the overall direction of society. But whatever, I get it. It's got to flow with it. But in the meanwhile, it's kind of changing the product a bit, and it's weird. In some ways, boxing always seems to reclaim it, but I don't know if it'll be enough. We'll have to see. As far as the heavyweight thing goes, though, so there have been kind of rumors that kind of mixing and matching with the subject here, that Oleksandr Usyk, who won the cruiserweight World Boxing Super Series and unified the cruiserweight division, became the, you know, undisputed champion. There have been rumors that he and Tony Bellew are in negotiations to make a fight, and it sounds like, you know, that could have at least some sort of impact on the heavyweight division. I'm not really sold on Bellew as a heavyweight, but that's a pretty solid entry. If Oleksandr Usyk is able to get that win, that's a pretty solid way to introduce himself to the division. But then the news in the last few days has been that the next season of the World Boxing Super Series is going to also have another cruiserweight tournament. So in addition to the bantamweights and the junior welterweights, they're going to have another tournament of cruiserweights. And I just kind of wanted to, I mean, we've touched on the World Boxing Super Series before and tournaments in general, but I don't know. I love tournaments. I've always liked tournaments. I've always liked that kind of single elimination style. You know, to me, that's a, usually a real neat way to package up a nice little competition in boxing, and usually it's fights that wouldn't otherwise happen, you know, matching guys that usually wouldn't otherwise fight or wouldn't have fought at that time or something like that. But what do you think about this whole World Boxing Super Series business and potentially another introduction for another cruiserweight into the heavyweight division?
I love it. I'm just like you. I love tournaments. I love anything that moves boxing more in the direction of a league where, as you said, I mean, look at Andre Ward. Look at who Andre Ward had to fight as a result of being in tournaments. It's a key example. I mean, had that been in the United States, you would have had tremendous marketability, you know, upshare for him as a result of that. But because it was on foreign soil, it wasn't really seen in the U.S. But as, you know, once tournaments demonstrate bankability, or, you know, to help people buy stock in people they don't know, or to really legitimize people that they semi-know, I think it should all move in that direction, because I think the sport for far too long has been defined by the fights that don't happen rather than the fights that do, or that when the fights do happen, they happen at the wrong time and all of that kind of thing. Leagues, you know, push everybody in the direction of, you know, trying to produce the best with less anyway, market considerations. So I love it. And I love, you know, I think the fight you mentioned with Ballou and the winner of that previous tournament, I think really great fight. Whoever wins is in a really interesting position, a kind of wild card position, and the, you know, the heavyweight title sweepstakes. I don't know if I'm entirely sold on Ballou either, but I really like watching him fight. I really like his personality, and I really like the way he fights, and I love his ambition. You know, he seemingly wants to be David to any of these Goliaths that are out there, and I would like to watch. I mean, I wouldn't favor him, But I would really like to watch him fight. I mean, I think him fighting Fury would be a lot of fun to see. And it just reminds me of some of like the fun fights that were in the 80s and early 90s, you know, kind of bonkers matchups that you saw, you know, David Tua and Michael Moore made for really memorable, fun fights, or Holyfield fighting Bert Cooper, where Bert Cooper almost knocked out Holyfield. You know, shit can happen if you mix and match these styles, and I wish boxing did it more. I wish there were, you know, more elite fights, less Super Bowls, and more sort of playoff-type fights.
Yeah, that's the thing, is, and I've mentioned this many times before, but it's just, it's strange because you see what boxing used to be and kind of how it used to more or less operate and how it does now. You know, gradually, it changed gradually. So along the way, it was just kind of like, you know, we didn't notice the change until we looked back and kind of in a capsule, and you realize that now the idea of contenders all squaring off against each other in order to create, you know, more and more firm or more and more convincing contenders, because they've run the gauntlet, so to speak, because they've all, you know, sharpened their edges against each other, as it were. That thing is not really a thing that happens anymore. Not largely, anyway. Not generally. At least not when there's a division where there are names to make money off of, to exploit, to make big money matchups off of, that might not necessarily be relevant to the direction of the division, because there is no apparent plan or ranking system or anything like that based off of this fight. I mean, it's a welterweight is the perfect example, and not only is welterweight the perfect example, but it really kind of ties into a lot of the stuff with Premier Boxing Champions, where a lot of these name fighters, Danny Garcia, you know, Keith Thurman, Sean Porter, where a lot of these guys are kind of, you know, again, fighting once, twice a year, three times a year tops. Two of the fights are kind of crappy. One of them is against a fellow contender. And the fight that's against a fellow contender is like, holy shit, it's Super Bowl season. Oh my God, this showdown. You guys got to catch this King of fucking Brooklyn, the Prince of Minneapolis. It's like everything is this massive event, when it's like, no, this is a contender versus another contender. This is a fight that is just supposed to happen. This is not some big ass gift to us. And this kind of ties into what I was saying earlier to you about the Canelo Golovkin 2 undercard, where everybody's like, oh my God, this is awesome. This is, you know, the best undercard since blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, dude, you're paying fucking $80 for this. It's supposed to be a good undercard. It's supposed to be good. You're paying that much money for it. Why is that a surprise? But that's what I'm saying, is that the mentality is that these fights that are just kind of everyday fights in any other era of boxing are treated as if they're, you know, they're the shit. They're put up on a pedestal, and that affects the overall view of the sport and the other things that are happening in the sport.
Totally agree. I like that they're making this push for these tournaments to happen. I think it's really positive. I just think you need to have some people that are emblematic of it's a successful way to go for everybody. You know, it helps sell the sport. It helps sell the fighters. And, you know, because as you say, like the business of this has just corrupted it in a way where the business model largely is not defined in any way by customer satisfaction. It's just defined by essentially, you know, not ripping off fans, but occasionally ripping off fans, but just the box office. That's what it is. And you look at a lot of examples, with movies, a lot of monster successes have not saved movie theaters, because, you know, the general experience of people is that they're going in to see stuff thinking it's going to be enjoyable, and it's not. And as far as the people making it, they've succeeded because they got their money, but the dissatisfaction is not a major factor in where they're going with their next movie. And I just wish kind of boxing would learn from that. And there's a lot of other examples of it, you know, that if you have unhappy customers, you're in a shitty place. And they only seem to be catering to, not catering, but structuring their business model along the lines of like drug dealers, that we have a bunch of hardened addicts or casinos that 10% of the people who walk in, their lives are ruined because they'll never leave. You know, they'll bankrupt everything to stay with it. Instead of, you know, seeking to make an overall satisfied general buyer of things. And, you know, I think most, if we think of like casual boxing fans that we would bring to a fight, do you think on average most of the cards that are available, like in New York or on the West Coast, are things that a casual sports fan would enjoy? I don't. Like, I don't think most boxing would do that. I think that there are anomalies to that. There are anomalies where I brought girlfriends to fights and they're just like, this was fucking amazing, and I don't know who those guys are. I don't know the history of boxing, but you could just feel the excitement and the intensity and the crowd being into it. But I think those are more often than not the exception. And I, you know, I think tournaments and that kind of thing could help move it in a better direction.
Right, and I think that, you know, there's a lot of legal mumbo-jumbo involved in tournaments, and there's a lot of promotional, you know, bull jive when it comes to matching different guys with different promoters. Hey, you know, I don't know if a lot of people remember, but, I mean, it really wasn't that long ago. Showtime did a bantamweight tournament. You know, like I said, it really was not very long ago. It was 2009, 2010, where it involved fighters with Don King, with what's his name, Gary, that freaking dude, whatever, the dude with the gray hair, the stupid ass Gary, whatever his name is. Yeah, it involved multiple promoters coming together, and it was not, you know, an easy thing to do, say, and I get it. But it seems to pay off whenever it's put together, because it locks these guys in, like you said, to matchups that they otherwise probably wouldn't be taking, and you know, especially with the previous success of the World Boxing Super Series, I'm all for it. Pretty much just count me in. It seems to me that for the most part they're doing things right, and unless there's just a group of totally crappy fighters they put together for this tournament or something, then yeah, I like.
I just think you need to get Mike Lee in every tournament. I think he's somebody that weight class shouldn't matter, and that the winner of every tournament, like Mike Lee, is the boss, like the video game style boss.
I'm actually thinking that, you know, they've named the trophy for the World Boxing Super Series. It's the Muhammad Ali Trophy. You know,
yeah,
they need
wrong.
To rethink that. I'm thinking it needs to be the Bobby Chez Trophy. I mean, there's no other way to go. And I'm kind of disappointed that they didn't even think of this or ask us. They didn't consult us in any way.
It hurts my feelings. And, you know, I recently did an Ancestry.com, so learning that I'm 22% Jewish, it just leads me to believe their anti-Semitism was at least played a part in their decision making, which, you know, it's heartbreaking.
You know, even just the possibility is sad, but that's, we do that kind of, you know, social justice, where we do that kind of civil action here on Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. It's a lifelong thing for us. I was also mentioning earlier. Go ahead.
I was just going to say,
we got to get it out.
Well, I think that there are a number of attorneys that listen to our show, and if any of them were interested in launching a class action lawsuit against some of these tournaments for, well, I guess discrimination against Bobby Chez, discrimination against serial drunk drivers, discrimination against Mensa members, and then the anti-Semitism in terms of not engaging in any kind of consultation with us in terms of the naming of the award, we'd like to talk to you.
That's true. You should be able to find a number on the webpage. And if you've experienced any symptoms like headaches, mesothelioma, restless leg syndrome, overactive bladder syndrome, don't call us.
Well, and as well, if any of your family members have, you know, died of cancer, I think there could be an argument to be made that this discrimination was a carcinogenic and in some way contributed to their death. And that kind of bereavement, you know, we're moving into murder, you know, premeditated murder on their part. That, you know, this is rapidly moving into, I think, like a global tragedy. And I can't blame Bobby for this. Bobby's a victim instead of a perpetrator for once. And that kind of role reversal is something I'm really glad that we were able to play a part in, because the redemption of Bobby Chez today, you know, for me, it's been a lifelong ambition.
It really is like a third act character arc closure type of, you know, type of thing. I really do like it. And if it's something that we can possibly bring to the masses who haven't already shut off the show with the shit we're talking about right now, then I'm just happy I can do it.
Exactly. Well, I mean, on a day where my building has no power and feels like a fucking third world situation with five trucks outside trying to restore it. I guess we were due for a little bit of silly humor at Bobby's expense.
Well, there's a lot of legal stuff in the news lately. You know, it's pretty interesting. Interesting times we live in. So I just like to further it. But on the what I had mentioned earlier, to rein it back in for a minute before we go, I had said that this whole Tyson Fury business was on the undercard of Carl Frampton versus Luke Jackson. To be totally frank here, no disrespect to Carl Frampton, who is a very good fighter, and holds some sort of interim belt or something like that. And I'm a fan. I'm a firm believer that he's a world-class fighter. He's just kind of had a couple of flat performances here and there. Nonetheless, this card was not really about Carl Frampton for the most part, at least not from the overall boxing fan standpoint. I think most people were interested in seeing how Tyson Fury looked. And then, of course, mm-hmm. after the Wilder fight seemed to stem from the performance, that it was obvious that it turned into an announcement party for Wilder Fury, more or less. But lost in the shuffle is that Carl Frampton dominated an Australian opponent named Luke Jackson that was, you know, obviously just very outclassed. Wasn't a great matchup, but it's still a good a good fighter in a good division who I guess has some sort of future. We don't really know who he's going to be matching up against soon. I guess he's going after Oscar Valdez or something like that. But regardless, the only other takeaway, I think, was that Carl Frampton has a massive, massive fan base and support in Belfast that's just really kind of not something you see a lot of in the U.S. and is kind of shocking to a lot of U.S. fans, something we've talked about a lot before.
Oh, he absolutely does, and I think we've talked about it before, but of anywhere where I've watched a fight, I've never seen anything close to what I saw in Belfast in terms of the intensity of fans. And, I mean, that was for a fucking journeyman fighting Rigo. But, I mean, that place rivaled Miguel Cotto fights, even though it was a fraction of the amount of fans who were there. I mean, it was just I've just never seen anything like it. I think I mentioned just anecdotally that the driver of Team Rigo, while we were there, refused to enter the arena because he was afraid of a riot. There were riot police there. He was afraid of getting stabbed, so he just literally had the engine running outside the arena for after Rigo was going to knock out Willie Casey. That sounds like hyperbole, but I promise you, I was walking out to the ring with Rigo, it didn't feel like it. I was scared to death. Like, just in the entourage going to the ring, those fans were the most ferocious I've ever seen. And Frampton's a great champion, except for the fact that he wouldn't fight Rigo. You know, Battle of the Jackal / El Chacal would be really, really fun. I mean, I'd still like to see it. And I, at this point, with Rigo being 65 years old, I mean, I think it would be really competitive and interesting and good money maker for Rigo, you know, where there's not many fights out there where he can make the kind of money he's been making with, you know, Al Heyman or Jay-Z style contracts. So, you know, Frampton's a lot of fun, and it's especially fun seeing him fight before an Irish audience. So yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's good stuff, and I can only hope that in a couple weeks here, when we wind up getting Canelo versus Golovkin too, that we wind up getting a pretty good crowd and a good fight and a good card and blah blah blah. I mean, real quick before we go, I mentioned it earlier, but what's your quick observation on the undercard being announced and the you know, the little hubbub about it?
You know, it's funny to me that the tenor of Golovkin and Canelo has become so nasty. I mean, I'm getting all these emails from the people managing press for it. Like, they seem really excited that the tenor has become so negative and nasty. And it's kind of put me off it. And I think it's put off a lot of people. One of the things that was, I think, a major selling point of this fight that they seem oblivious to was that it didn't need all the bullshit to sell it. It didn't need the sizzle because it had the stake. You knew these guys were going to fight in a way that was pleasing. They had a lot to prove. You know, once we know that Golovkin's a little pissed off, that's it. I don't need to know more. I don't need all the steroid accusations, regardless of their veracity. I just want to see the fight happen. And it seems like this kind of tone is something that's just unpleasant. You know, like it's like a really good meal, but the sauce is kind of too much or something, for me anyway. And if it's putting me off of it, where I'm, you know, like a gluttonous pig for these kind of fights, I can only imagine that it might adversely be affecting like the general fan, but maybe I'm way off on that. But I just noticed, like, I don't, it set the tone for me in a way that's dominated even like parsing the undercard. Is I'm like, even the main fight I'm there to see, the main course, is kind of like, I don't like this tone. I mean, am I way off on that, or do you know sort of where I'm coming from?
I do know where you're coming from. For me, it's something similar, and I think that it's not so much the tone per se, because, like, I don't really mind trash talk. I don't mind when guys are, you know, even getting kind of nasty, or there's skirmishes, scuffles, something like that, as long as it's nothing, like, serious, nobody's getting, like, stabbed or some shit. But, I mean, I don't mind stuff like that, and sometimes that can add to a fight. Sometimes it can make it more exciting, kind of raise the stakes a little bit. For me, the issue is that the whole Canelo Golovkin 2 build up, they both of them just kind of sound a little bit like bitter. It's not like nasty to
me.
That's
exactly
right. It's not so much that they're being like mean per se. It's just that they both sound like they're like, ugh, I should have won that shit. Yeah, you know, that's what it sounds like to me. And, like, why are we having to do this again? I should have won the first time. Like, well, dude, you're fucking getting paid a grip to do this again. And, I mean, it was a draw. So we want it. So do it. It's, damn. Why does it have to be? Why do you guys have to be whining about it? But, and that's kind of what it comes off like to me. And, yeah, it's I think, more of a turn off for us than it is casual fans, because there's only so many casual fans who are going to tune into a Canelo fight. Obviously, he's very popular, but it's not. Neither of these guys are Floyd Mayweather. Nobody is, but regardless, you know, it's not. I don't know that it's on that level.
No, I agree, and yeah, bitter is the right word, and bitter is a hard one to sell. It's really hard to make bitterness, and it's, you know, like a draw. And
totally.
Also that both of these guys are so synonymous with
antithetical feelings to bitterness. You know, Canelo was a pretty feel-good story in terms of taking some really dangerous fights, fighting in an exciting way, you know, very charismatic, heir apparent to sort of De La Hoya. Golovkin was a very feel-good story, almost always very exciting in the ring. And suddenly it's just kind of like, wow, after a really exciting first fight, I'm not like amped up for this. And I have to sort of place blame with, that mutual bitterness and sort of like, okay, we'll take the fight because there's so much money. But like almost this posturing of like martyrdom that they're taking the fight, like it's just not a good look for anybody. And as I say, like seeing these emails that are just the trainers calling each other out or the fighters are accusing each other of steroids. It's just, I don't know. It just all feels like a downer to me.
And it's kind of weak.
It is weak. Yeah. It's bizarre.
Well, we got about 40 seconds left, so it gives me just about enough time to say thank you to everybody who tuned in today. Sorry for the wonky time and a little bit of background noise, but whatever. Not a big deal. Bryn, always a good time. Follow him on Twitter, Brynicio, B-R-I-N-I-C-I-O. Follow me, Patrick Connor, at Patrick M. Connor. Go to the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio page on Facebook, and also rate us on iTunes, because that's appreciated. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Patrick. Talk to you soon. Thanks, everybody.
Take it easy, people.